Another deadly day for Palestinians as a young man succumbs to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid on the West Bank city of Jenin last month. Military rulers in Niger have expelled ambassadors of France, Germany, and Nigeria for taking actions contrary to the interests of the African nation. And Russia says it has shot down more than 70 Ukrainian drones in different parts of the country while responding to attacks by striking port infrastructure in Ukraine. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. And now, a young Palestinian man has succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin last month. 20-year-old man, identified as Izzaldin Kanan, was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper. He was on his way to donate blood to victims of the Israeli raid. Israel launched a deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp in early July. It was the regime's fiercest incursion into the West Bank in two decades. Two-day onslaught left over a dozen Palestinians dead before regime troops were forced to withdraw due to retaliatory operations by resistance fighters. Israeli forces carry out attacks on Palestinians almost on a daily basis. Regimes killed at least 230 since start of the year and arrested many more. The Hamas resistance movement has vowed a swift response to Israeli attacks against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. A Hamas spokesperson described the raids as a violation of sanctities and freedom of worship. He added, "Israeli regime is deluded if it assumes it can force Palestinians out by committing such crimes." On Friday, Israeli forces attacked Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque with tear gas and rubber bullets. At least 8, including an elderly person, were injured. Iran's army has held large-scale electronic warfare drills in the country's central areas. The Navy, Army, and Air Force all took part in the exercises. The drills involved assessing various types of systems used in electronic warfare. They included fixed mobile, ground, base, and airborne systems. Exercises also featured Iranian Army's drones, micro-aerial vehicles, and other military equipment. Commander of the drill said Iran is boosting its defensive and offensive capabilities. Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari stressed Iran has no intention to attack any country but will respond decisively to any aggression. President Ebrahim Raisi hails Iran's admission to the BRICS group of 5 major emerging economies. He says Iran's cooperation with BRICS and similar organizations will have a major benefit for the country.
Iran's membership in BRICS will increase the country's political power. Cooperation with powerful international organizations will boost Iran's political power in addition to bringing economic benefits for the country.
Raisi added the accession is in line with Iran's national interests. Iranian president also lauded the role of new emerging blocs such as BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in confronting unilateralism. Raisi made the remarks upon arrival in Tehran after taking part in a BRICS summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. There, bloc's leaders invited Iran and 5 other countries, including Saudi Arabia, to join the group.
Iran has been invited to become a member of the BRICS group of emerging economies, whose leaders have attended a summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss the bloc's expansion. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced on Thursday that the BRICS member states agreed to admit Iran to the bloc.
We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
The 5 current member states have reached a consensus on the first phase of this expansion process. Reacting to the news, Mohammad Jamshidi, the Iranian president's deputy chief of staff for political affairs, said Iran's membership in BRICS is a historical development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said Tehran seeks to promote cooperation with the member states of the BRICS group of emerging economies. He also noted that Iran, in its foreign policy, has put the promotion of relations with all independent countries in the world on its agenda.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has said the expansion of BRICS will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. This expansion has reflected BRICS' determination for unity and cooperation. He said this membership expansion is historic. The expansion is also a new starting point for BRICS cooperation. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism and further strengthen the force for world peace and development. Russia has also welcomed Iran's application and the group's expansion to include international powerhouses. Meanwhile, South Africa's foreign minister has said that leaders of the BRICS bloc have agreed on mechanisms for considering new members, giving dozens of interested nations a path into the organization.
Now, the BRICS group accounts for 26% of global gross domestic product. Bloc considers itself a counterweight to Western powers. It is opposed to the use of financial payment systems for political purposes, and for that reason, BRICS leaders have all backed the idea of using local currencies to facilitate trade. They're also planning to create a unified currency as an alternative to the U.S. dollar.
The inclusion of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, and Egypt marks the first MENA representation in the group, and the inclusion of Argentina was championed by member Brazil. The expansion of the group is part of its plan to build dominance and to reshape global governance into a multipolar world order.
Excellencies, we are moving towards a multipolar world, and that is a positive thing. But multipolarity in itself is not enough to guarantee a peaceful or just global community. To be a factor of peace, equity, and justice in international relations, multipolarity must be supported by strong and effective multilateral institutions.
UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed said he appreciated the inclusion of his country as a new member of the important group. We respect the vision of BRICS leadership and appreciate the inclusion of the UAE as a member to this important group. We look forward to a continued commitment of cooperation for the prosperity, dignity, and benefit of all nations and people around the world. The bloc's expansion raises the question of potential de-dollarization, a process by which members would gradually switch to using currencies other than the U.S. dollar to conduct trade. The expansion also takes place at a time when some BRICS members, namely Russia and China, are locked into rising tensions with the West. Experts believe that choosing to include countries like Iran have opted to choose a foreign policy independent of the West could swing the group further toward becoming an anti-Western bloc. BRICS held its first summit in 2009 with four members and then added South Africa the following year. It launched its new development bank in 2015. More than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining BRICS, and 23 formally applied to join the club, which already represented a quarter of the global economy and 40% of the world's population.
Niger's military rulers have given the French, German, and Nigerian ambassadors just 48 hours to leave the African country. Niger's foreign ministry, in a separate statement, said the decision to expel the ambassadors was taken partly due to their refusal to respond to an invitation to meet with Niger's Minister of Foreign Affairs. Statement added other actions by the governments have been contrary to the interests of Niger. Paris, however, has dismissed the ultimatum, saying that Niger's junta has no authority to ask the French ambassador to leave. Germany and Nigeria have yet to comment. On a Friday, hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the French military base in Niamey, the capital, calling for the departure of foreign forces.
It's all part of the general mobilization we have here. It's to demand the departure of these invading forces, this occupying force, the French force here at Niamey Air Base. That's why we want to come to the door of this base to ask them to leave our country from here. We don't need this occupying force. We don't want them on our land.
Latest developments in Niger comes amid a series of anti-France demonstrations in the African country after the army overthrew President Mohamed Bazoum in July. Military leaders in Niamey have accused a former colonial power, France, of seeking to use force in order to reinstate Bazoum. They also said the Economic Community of West African States, led by Nigeria, is an organization in France's pocket. ECOWAS has imposed heavy economic sanctions on Niger following the coup and has threatened the country with military intervention. Hundreds of protesters take to the streets of Athens to vent anger at the Greek government's misconduct and the poor response to wildfires that continue to ravage the country for over a week now. And protesters have blamed the government for thousands of personnel shortages in the fire department as residents are forced to put out fires with buckets. They say a government's criminal policy has left a majority of people and their property unprotected to ensure profits of the few. Greece has been plagued by hundreds of wildfires in the past several days, resulting in the loss of more than 20 lives so far. Largest active fire is currently raging in northeastern regions, while another significant blaze has erupted on the northwestern outskirts of Athens itself. The wildfires in Greece have been the largest recorded on European soil in years and have burned more than 120,000 hectares this year. Russia says it's thwarted new Ukrainian drone and missile attacks in different regions of the country.
Over the past 24 hours, five HIMARS multiple rocket launchers and a U.S.-made HARM anti-radar missile were intercepted, as well as one converted S-200 anti-aircraft guided missile. Also, 73 Ukrainian unmanned drones were shot down and suppressed by means of electronic warfare.
The Defense Ministry spokesman also said that Russia destroyed a Ukrainian port infrastructure facility used for military purposes. Crimea and Moscow have been the main targets of Ukrainian airstrikes since May. Russia's launched its own air attacks on Ukrainian soil as well, mainly targeting the capital Kiev and southern regions. Rohingya Muslims in Bangladesh have been marking the sixth anniversary of their exodus from Myanmar following a military-led crackdown. Large crowds gathered in the district of Cox Bazar, which is considered the largest refugee camp in the world. A community leader addressed the emotional crowds who were saying that they see no future for themselves. Rohingya have been denied citizenship in their home country, Myanmar, and live in dire conditions in Bangladesh's overcrowded camps. Hundreds of thousands of them crossed into Bangladesh in 2017 after a crackdown by Myanmar's military and extremist Buddhist mobs, which included mass killings and gang rapes, as well as arson attacks on their villages. UN's described Rohingya as the most persecuted minority in the world, and the tragedy against them as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. And now, there seems to be no end to the legal trouble surrounding former U.S. President Donald Trump. In a new case, the Republican figure has been booked at a jail in Atlanta, Georgia. He was later released after posting $200,000 on bond and accepting bail that bars him from contacting witnesses or his co-defendants in the case. Romy Mazzaheri has your story from Chicago.
For the first time in United States history, a former president now has a mugshot. Donald Trump has been arrested in Georgia and is being prosecuted under racketeering charges for allegedly trying to subvert the state's 2020 presidential election votes. 70% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents still say President Joe Biden's election was not legitimate.
You should be able to challenge an election. I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election. And I should have every right to do that. As you know, you have many people that you've been watching over the years do the same thing, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Stacey Abrams or many others.
It's the fourth arrest for Trump in 5 months, even as Trump is running neck and neck with Biden in 2024 election polls. That has many accusing the ruling Democrats of election interference and of weaponizing the judicial system against political opponents, and of dangerously dividing the country.
Because it was dragged on for so many years, and it was really made into a theater. And Donald Trump was able to use this, ironically, to build his brand, to build this this lie that the election was stolen, and really, really just brainwashed millions of people, you know, into continuing to support him. I think it really spells disaster for the unity of the ruling class.
Trump's popularity among Republicans has soared since the first indictment, and he seems certain to be their candidate next year. Polls show the nation is almost perfectly split regarding Trump's 4 court cases and 91 felony charges. While a part of the United States has become galvanized both for and against Trump, for decades the United States has been defined by political apathy, low voter turnout rates, and disinterest in Washington politics seen as so corrupt it's routinely referred to as the swamp.
It seems like a lot of work, and typically I feel like people that high up don't really ever get convicted of anything, so it might be a lot of time and money and effort going towards nothing at the end, so I don't know.
The 2024 presidential campaign began this week with the first Republican Party primary debate, but the focus was on Donald Trump, and the focus will likely remain on Trump for at least the next 15 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Nearly 4 million working days have been lost to industrial action in Britain in the past year or so. A new study has found that strikes in the United Kingdom sparked by soaring inflation and years of stagnating pay are Britain's most intensive strikes since the 1980s. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Express has covered this story and tells us more. Exclusive polling by Omnisys found 62% of Britons believe that Britain's economy is getting worse, with a mere 11% saying it is getting better. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak recently claimed there is light at the end of the tunnel, with average weekly pay going up by 7.8% in the 3 months to June. But voters still think the country is heading into trouble. With Labour Party at 36% in the opinion polls and the Conservatives on 23%, the Prime Minister is under pressure to close the gap ahead of the next general election. And the Treasury is taking action to show it is on the side of consumers. Minister Andrew Griffith signalled he wants banks to pass on the benefits of higher interest rates to savers. He said, "I and colleagues have been very clear we want to see savers, who have had a tough deal in recent years, offered the most competitive range of choices. Banks have also been warned that they will face fines if they fail to provide free cash withdrawal and deposit services within 1 mile of customers in urban areas and 3 miles in rural parts." The government is now facing calls to accelerate economic growth, prominent economist Shankar Singham said. It is good inflation appears to be coming down, but the government needs to focus like a laser on how to reduce energy costs for consumers and also costs in sectors such as transportation, housing and retail banking. Singham added, if we are to avoid stagflation, we must grow the economy. John Longworth of the Independent Business Network added, inflation will come down and the Bank of England must avoid even more damage by continuing to increase interest rates and pushing the UK into recession. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. According to new analysis, nearly 4 million working days have been lost to industrial action and strikes in the past year, which finds that strikes sparked by soaring inflation and years of stagnating pay are Britain's most intensive strikes since the 1980s. As workers battle with the government and private employers to ease severe real-term wage cuts, the extent to which key sectors have ground to a halt, at times literally, has been further evidenced in a new report by the Resolution Foundation. Published as junior doctors continue a four-day walkout, the think tank finds that sectors including healthcare, education, postal services and railways have been responsible for 96% of all days lost to strike action since 2021. Laying bare the squeeze facing workers, the report found that real-term pay in the 3 months to May was 4.1% lower for all workers than in 2021, with that hit deepening to 9.2% for those in the public sector and to 9.8% in healthcare and social care. Correspondingly, the report found this appears to have contributed to an increase in job vacancies, with the number of available roles in healthcare, education and public administration 33% higher in March than in December of 2019, and up 23% across the rest of the economy. Industrial action has been waged on a scale not seen for decades in the past year, with walkouts hitting the National Health Service, railways, airports, schools, universities, postal services, the civil service and the media industry, among others. In public sector pay battles, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's insistence that granting workers' demands would further fuel inflation means his government has continued to take a tough line, despite opposition MPs warning of the strike's impact on an economy already dicing with recession. Ministers have frequently been charged failing to properly negotiate with the unions, while often bizarrely seeking to use the chaos to score political points against the Labour Party, despite Keir Starmer's visibly less than sympathetic stance on the matter. Meanwhile, the government's anti-strike legislation finally passed into law recently, despite several defeats in the House of Lords. But although ministers have now finally agreed pay settlements with several groups, including nurses and teachers, industrial action is still waged on several fronts, including by junior doctors and by railway workers, with the latter marking the first on a national scale since the 1980s. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered the same story. According to a report by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, the unemployment rate in Britain has reached its highest level in nearly 2 years. The report said the spike was mainly driven by an increase in the number of people unemployed for up to 6 months. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, the number of out-of-work people increased to 4.2% compared to 4% recorded in the 3 months to the end of May, as the amount of job vacancies dropped by 66,000 to 1.02 million. Meanwhile, wages have risen, with private sector wage growth increasing to 8.2%, more than a key measure of inflation. Average weekly earnings, excluding bonuses, hit an annual growth rate of 7.8%, reaching record highs. However, the growth was outpaced by the rate of price rises in Britain, meaning an effective pay cut for the working population in Britain. The country remains in the grips of a severe cost of living crisis, with a higher inflation rate than other major European countries. Data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, showed that private rental prices paid by tenants in the United Kingdom have jumped by 5.3% in the 12 months leading up to July, marking the largest annual percentage change since records began in 2016. The figure was up from 5.2% in the previous month, with costs consistently increasing over the past 2 years. According to the Office for National Statistics, annual private rental prices surged by 5.2% in England, 6.5% in Wales, and 5.7% in Scotland. Within England, the highest annual percentage change in private rental prices was in the West Midlands, Yorkshire, and the Humber, and in London at 5.5%, while the northeast of England saw the lowest increase at 4.6%. The Office for National Statistics figures also showed house price growth slowing down, rising 1.7% in the 12 months to June, down from 1.8% increase in May, and well below the peak of 14% in July of last year.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us ponder on these words of wisdom from the Holy Prophet's elder grandson and second infallible heir, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him. Glory is to give in loss and forgive the sin, while chivalry is to safeguard the religion, promote the personality, be lenient, sustain in doing favours, fulfil the rights, and behave amicably towards people.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, be very careful who you get your religion from. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, welcome. It is such an honor to be here at your service. What we're talking about today, very quickly and briefly, is to be very careful where we get our religion from. Now, of course, when we are talking about an Islamic lifestyle, well, we need to learn that Islamic lifestyle one way or the other. Now, of course, one way to learn this Islamic lifestyle is to go to the source, which is the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, as well as the Holy Quran. But sometimes, yes, we can get some basic things like that, and if we have good self-motivation, we can actually learn quite a bit in this manner, by going towards the traditions and the riwayat and the ahadith of the Messenger of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, that are accepted. This is one way, of course, and the Holy Quran, if we have the motivation. Sometimes, though, unfortunately, we kind of don't have the motivation to do that on our own. Some people, they prefer to go and listen to a religious scholar. They prefer to listen to the ulama, and this is how they learn, you know, about the Holy Quran, and they learn about the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Now, both ways are good. Most probably to do both ways is better instead of just choosing one. Yes, we should have our own, you know, time to read the traditions. We should find our own time to read the Holy Quran and try to understand as best as we can, of course. But for the more intricate details and the fine lines that need to be understood, then yes, we need to refer, and we must refer to the ulama, the religious scholars, to understand the Holy Quran at a higher level and to understand the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam at a higher level with more depth and to understand more of its complexities. Now, this is what we're talking about here, is be careful who you learn your religion from. Now, of course, there are individuals who claim to be scholars, but they are not. There are people who sit on the pulpit of the Messenger of Allah, but they do not have the credibility to do so. And it is our duty to be very careful who we listen to, because it will have an effect on our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about being very careful who we listen to when it comes to our religion. There are many, many speakers out there, and it can be quite overwhelming at times if you look at it through this lens, that there are people out there who, you know, might be claiming to know the religion, but they don't. One of the things that we find in the traditions themselves is that when you are looking for an individual, be very careful if they instill the respect and the fear, the reverential fear of the Almighty Allah in your heart, then that is a good speaker. If they clear up the lines between truth and falsehood, then that is a reliable speaker. And of course, if they are dealing with the problems at hand, if they are creating awareness, if they are really helping to guide the people, you know, these are certain qualities and characteristics that will help you to be able to find a speaker that can help you. But without any embarrassment or without any shame, We humbly believe, and we really believe, I guess, that one of the best scholars to be able to follow is Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. His words on the traditions and the Quran is truly amazing. And if you're looking for a religious scholar of the highest caliber who can help to differentiate between right and wrong, truth and falsehood, and really help us to live an Islamic lifestyle, then Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei is definitely one of the best scholars to be able to do so.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
20 years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Part 2.
Sky may be the only place you can find peace in Afghanistan. Because from up here, bad incidents become so small that they're not visible anymore. If the only criterion is people, life in Afghanistan goes on, like anywhere else in the world. In here, people live together despite their differences. In today's Afghanistan, it doesn't matter if life goes on fast or slowly. In here, incidents set the cycle of life in motion, or even stop it. People have no role in these incidents. The incidents come to the country from outside. The problem in Afghanistan today is these incidents. In 2010, the New York Times hinted at the collaboration between the U.S. Geological Survey and the Pentagon. The collaboration was to estimate the value of the mines in Afghanistan by using samples. This is the most prominent figure in the Pentagon, who was the commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East until 2010. General David Petraeus. As the highest-ranking U.S. military commander in Afghanistan, he had this to say about mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is blessed with the presence of what are trillions, with an S on the end, trillions of dollars worth of minerals, if and only if you can get the extractive technology, the human capital operated, the lines of communication to enable you to get it out of the country and all the rest of that. Very big if, and of course there's a foundation of security. That would be necessary on which to build all of that. But again, the prospects are very significant if you can achieve objectives.
There are many estimates about the value of mines in Afghanistan, from $1 to $3 trillion to dozens of trillions of dollars.
There's a figure floating out there that it's actually $3 trillion, and I've heard a figure of $30 trillion.
In 1998, Congress published a report on the vitality of mineral resources in Central Asian countries for the U.S. At the same time, the U.S.'s main problem was to transfer the oil and gas to the market. The U.S.'s ideal was to construct a pipeline in Afghanistan and transfer it to Pakistan and India to get access to high seas. India's Outlook News Agency says Bush's main goal by attacking Afghanistan was pipeline politics. But after a while, with more investigation, it came to light that besides international transit, Afghanistan has some mines that are worth more than the mines anywhere else in Central Asia. Uranium. A strategic stone with vast resources in Afghanistan's Helmand province, where the U.S. and British troops were stationed in large numbers. Chromite industrial stone can be found in Khost and Logar provinces. Marble can be found in various parts of Afghanistan in large deposits, and dozens of other types of precious stones in Afghanistan. The bluest stone in the world is Badakhshan's azure. Emerald in Panjshir, gold in Badakhshan, tourmaline in Kunar, chondrodite, quartz and various types of topaz, prosylite, aquamarine and agate. After uranium, the next strategic mineral that Afghanistan has the biggest deposits in the world is copper. In our era, copper is more valuable. because it has a basic role in renewable technologies like wind turbines and solar panels.
As the world electrifies, and whether it's moving towards green energy, whether it's solar or wind, what does that require? An enormous amount of copper. When you have every megawatt of wind power installed requires 7 tons of copper.
Since Eric Prince is involved in renewable energy's business, he knows well how vital the copper mines in Afghanistan are.
And if you build a mine, right, there's a place like Mas Aynak. It's 50 kilometers south of Kabul. It's the largest copper deposit in the world, more than 6 million tons of copper. Do it manually. I'll employ 10,000 Afghans with picks and shovels and pay them $12 a day. The Taliban's paying 10, we pay 12. I take great umbrage when people say, Eric Prince wants to privatize this and make money. Yeah, I'm going to make money. I would try to make money.
Talc. The name of the mineral might not sound familiar to many people. The white material can be found in abundance in Afghanistan. Besides the wrong methods of extraction that can irreversibly damage the mines, the bitter reality is, based on a report by Global Witness in 2018, a large part of the talc mines in Afghanistan are in the hands of Daesh. The militant group has been mercilessly extracting and exporting talc and has achieved considerable financial resources. But where does the huge amount of talc is exported to? Global Witness published a report in 2016. Based on the report, almost all of the talc in Afghanistan goes to the U.S. and European countries via Pakistan. So the United States can indirectly benefit from the Daesh presence in Afghanistan because it can easily get inexpensive smuggled talc without having to foot any security bill. So it's easy to guess why the U.S. isn't serious about uprooting Daesh in Afghanistan. Talc is an important material for many industries, the plastic industry, paint industries, and ceramics. Talc is the main element in baby powder. The famous U.S. brand Johnson & Johnson is one of the biggest consumers of talc in the world. Peter Frankopan, British writer and researcher, explicitly tells us about the relationship between the talc used in baby powder and Daesh.
The relationship between baby powder and global world power. Can you expand on that sort of dilemma a little bit?
Talcum powder is the world is the softest powder known to mankind, right? And it's found, like lapis and like gold, almost exclusively in Afghanistan. And ISIS-K, which is sort of the Central Asian variant of ISIS-Daesh. So ISIS-K have been very effective in trying to work out what assets produce cash. And one of the things they've targeted are the talcum mines in Afghanistan. And that brings them estimates around about, Global Witness did the work on this, somewhere between $20 and $30 million a year minimum. And that's quite a lot of cash. That powder has come from probably ISIS-controlled territory, shipped out through Pakistan, through legal or illegal.
Dasht-e-Nawar Desert Plateau in the Ghazni province. At the heart of the desert, there exists one of the most special needs of human beings today, lithium. Many people call it the oil of the 21st century.
Lithium in Afghanistan. So certainly the lithium deposits are not that common. These are salts that rapidly erode into the ocean. So finding them in on land is difficult. With the rise in the electronics industry, the need for lithium is only going to increase. And so you can imagine these are worth quite a bit of money.
Any electronic gadget that is charged and anything that has a battery needs lithium. The expansion of electric vehicles is something that has increased our need for lithium severalfold. Eric Prince's engagement in the field of electric vehicles can be another reason behind his attachment to the mines in Afghanistan.
Working on a fund, a bigger investment fund, to do some of the strategic minerals that you need to make electric vehicles, right? There's a big shift coming in electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are coming.
The vast resources of lithium deposits in Afghanistan led to the realization of a prediction. Afghanistan became Saudi Arabia of lithium.
And the New York Times described it very, very well, calling Afghanistan the lithium country, the Saudi Arabia of lithium. So where Saudi Arabia is the oil capital of the world, Afghanistan will be the lithium capital of the world.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The bosses of Britain's most prominent companies have taken home average pay increases of about £4 million in 2022. This during the cost of living crisis, where most Britons are grappling with how to pay for the rising prices of basic items such as food and energy. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a recent research study, the chief executive officers of Britain's biggest firms have received significant pay hikes, whilst millions of British workers struggle with soaring inflation. The High Pay Centre director, Luke Hilliard, said, "At a time when so many households are struggling with living costs and an economic model that prioritises a £500,000 pay rise for executives who are already multimillionaires is surely going wrong somewhere." Criticising the monumental wage difference between British company bosses and the average full-time worker in Britain, Luke Hilliard further emphasised, "How major employers distribute the wealth that their workforce creates has a big impact on people's living standards." He added, "We need to give workers more voice on company boards, strengthen trade union rights, and enable low and middle income earners to get a fairer share in relation to those at the top." General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, the TUC, Paul Novak, has also slammed the wage difference, saying, "While millions of British families have seen their budget shredded by the cost of living crisis, City of London directors have enjoyed bumper pay rises." Paul Novak underlined, "This is why workers must be given seats on company boards to inject some much-needed common sense and restraint. We need an economy that delivers better living standards for all the people, not just for those at the top." According to the annual research from the High Pay Center, the median pay of a FTSE 100 chief executive officer last year hit £3.91 million, the highest level since 2017, and £500,000 higher than 2021. The Press Association, PA Media, has also covered the same story. According to new research, the bosses of Britain's biggest companies saw their pay surge by 16% last year, as most workers saw their pay packets outstripped by inflation. The High Pay Centre said chief executive officers for firms on the FTSE 100, the index of Britain's largest publicly listed companies, had an average pay rise of around £500,000, £500,000 in 2022. Union said the data shows that Britain has become a land of grotesque extremes. The High Pay Centre said median pay for a FTSE 100 chief executive officer increased from £3.38 million in 2021 to £3.91 million in 2022. It represents a continued upward trend after it dropped to £2.46 million in 2020 as companies were impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The research shows that the gap between bosses and workers widened further over the past year, with it recording that the median FTSE 100 chief executive officer was paid 118 times the median British full-time worker salary, up from 108 times in 2021. The AstraZeneca boss, Pascal Soriot, was the highest-earning FTSE 100 chief executive after receiving a pay of £15.3 million for the year. Other particularly highly paid chief executives included Charles Woodburn of British Aerospace Systems, Bernard Looney of British Petroleum BP, and Ben Van Burden of Shell. The High Pay Centre has called for new requirements for companies to include a minimum of 2 elected workforce representatives on the remuneration committees that set executive pay. Over the past year, multiple British public sectors, from junior doctors and teachers to rail staff and bus drivers, have all been striking as their wages remain the same despite the economic crisis. Although Britain's inflation level is hovering at 6.8%, down from 7.8% in June, the country recently recorded the highest price increases among the group of 7 G7 industrialised nations. The Bank of England has increased its key interest rate more than a dozen times in succession to try to lower inflation. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered the same story. According to a separate study by housing charity Shelter, one-third of working tenants in England do not have enough savings to pay rent if they lose their job, which puts them at risk of losing their homes amid the cost of living crisis in the country. Shelter's survey of more than 2,000 tenants found that 55% had seen their rent go up this year, and 37% were struggling to pay or had already fallen behind as a result of an increase. Polly Neat, Shelter's chief executive, said private renters were facing a crisis like never before. She added, "The severe lack of social homes means swathes of people are barely scraping by as they're forced to compete for grossly expensive private rentals because there is nothing else to rent." She underlined, "With food and household bills continuing to surge, the situation is precarious for thousands of renters who are one paycheck away from losing their home and a specter of homelessness. According to official government data for January to March of this year, published in July, around 79,840 households were owed help from local authorities to address homelessness or the risk of homelessness, as experts blamed a shameful lack of social housing in Britain. Data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, showed private rental prices paid by tenants in the United Kingdom have jumped by 5.3% in the 12 months leading up to July, marking the largest annual percentage change since records began in 2016. The figure was up from 5.2% in the previous month, with costs consistently increasing over the past 2 years. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, annual private rental prices surged by 5.2% in England, 6.5% in Wales, 5.7% in Scotland. Within England, the highest annual percentage change in private rental prices was in the West Midlands area, followed by Yorkshire and Humberside, and also London at 5.5%, while the northeast of England saw the lowest increase at 4.6%. According to the report, the average house price in the United Kingdom was £288,000 or $368,000 in June. Average house prices increased over the year by 1.9% to $391,000 in England, by 0.6% to $272,000 in Wales, and by 2.7% to $222,000 in Northern Ireland. House prices in Scotland stayed practically unchanged at an average of $241,000.
Midstream.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made his first visit to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia last week since the signing of the agreement to restore diplomatic relations between the two countries. Abdullahian met Saudi Arabia's crown prince in what was described as the first high-ranking Iranian official meeting with Mohammed bin Salman. Abdullahian also met his Saudi counterpart, Prince Faisal bin Farhan. The Iranian delegation also included the newly appointed ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Ali Reza Inayati, who said that the restoration of relations between the two countries will have important effects on stability and the culture of dialogue in the Middle East region. All the while, earlier this month, the Saudi embassy in Iran officially kicked off its work. The restoration of relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran under Chinese auspices was announced in Beijing on the 10th of last March. This event was one of the most prominent events that took place this year due to the impact of this reconciliation on regional files that have not witnessed a breakthrough in years. Saudi-Iranian relations had witnessed unprecedented tension over the past years. This tension began in 2016 after Saudi Arabia executed the Saudi Shia Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. However, the matter was not limited to Saudi Arabia only, but also included other Arab states in the Persian Gulf that took a stand alongside Saudi Arabia against Iran, even if the method differed from one country to another. This tension negatively affected the political and security situation in several countries such as Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. However, so far, the Yemeni file remains the highest priority for the two countries. Now, after the resumption of diplomatic relations between the two countries, these files remain stuck without any progress, in the hope that this return will lead to political solutions that will end the current crises. The two sides have agreed to solve these obstacles because they are the cornerstone of